Good morning, everyone. My name is Bob Waller. I'm a past president, CEO of Mayo Clinic. Welcome to the 20th IHI Annual Forum. Some of you may have seen a sign down the hall describing the forum, the most supercharging, super-duper event in the history of healthcare. We would agree. You know, Nashville is the home of country music. Down the road, Memphis is the home of rock and roll. This is the studio, the Sun Studio in Memphis, where Elvis recorded his first hits. I saw Elvis in Memphis a few weeks ago. And I'm certain it was Elvis because he gave me these genuine signature sunglasses. Well, actually, he sold them to me for $10. Whether in Memphis or Tennessee, or Nashville, the music in Tennessee is really fun and uplifting. So again, welcome to Tennessee and this wonderful meeting. I have the privilege to serve as chair of this outstanding board of directors of IHI. This year we say goodbye and a heartfelt thanks to Debbie Powell. Debbie is dean of the School of Medicine at the University of Minnesota, and she assumes the presidency of the American Association of American Colleges and other leadership roles in the nation. But we welcome Diana Chapman Walsh to the board. Diana recently completed her tenure as president of Wellesley College, and IHI is extremely fortunate to have Diana join the family. This is a photo next of the staff in Cambridge. Just over 100 strong. And about 90 of them are here in Nashville, most of them dressed in blue. And if you ever need an extra dose of energy, come to the offices in Cambridge. The level of energy there on a scale of 1 to 10 is about a 15. And you'll return home energized and refreshed. And of course, the staff and the faculty and the advisors and the board get their energy and inspiration from all of you who are about the work of changing the healthcare world. In these days and times, IHI is especially grateful for the leadership and support of our donors. They're listed here, and they've done so much to make possible the extraordinary work of IHI and all of you, which you know about so well. The 5 Million Lives campaign, led by Blue Cross and Blue Shield companies and the Cardinal Health Foundation, the Aetna Foundation, Blue Shield of California Foundation, Baxter International, Abbott Fund, and Colorado Trust, the very exciting Open School for Health Professions, led by Kaiser Permanente Community Benefit, the RX Foundation, and the MacArthur Foundation. IHI's work in the developing countries, which is marvelous work, the Health Foundation, the Brad Heyman Foundation, and the very important innovation and design work by the RX Foundation. And a very special thanks to the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association and their member plans. Their support of the 5 Million Lives campaign has just been vital to all the patients we serve. And so to them and to all of our philanthropic partners, thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, finally, it's my honor to introduce to you Dr. Vin Sahni. He's the Senior Vice President of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, one of the outstanding chairs of this year's forum. Then, as you know, has served IHI in many capacities since the beginning of the Institute, including chairing the Board of Directors. I've been privileged to be a pupil of then Sonny in the classroom, and I'm especially grateful to be a friend. Would you please welcome Vin Sonny to the podium?
Thank you, Bob. We are so fortunate to have your wisdom and a steady hand as chairman of IHI during these difficult economic times. It is my great honor to co-chair the 20th National Forum. I was co-chair of the National Forum 1. We had standing room only crowd in Boston. The room only accommodated 275 people, and we had 300. We actually had to stop enrollment because we thought we had far exceeded our expectation. At National Forum 2, which I also co-chaired, we doubled our attendance and we had 600 people. So it is great to see that at National Forum 20, we are just 20 times the attendance of about 6,000 people here. I like this metric, Don. We should judge all IHI initiatives using this formula. It is really my great pleasure to introduce Don Berwick, who really does not need any introduction. I've known Don since 1977, when both of us joined the Harvard School of Public Health as faculty. In 1986, Don decided that we needed to think about quality improvement in a different framework than the current practice at that point in time. He was like a lone ranger, the daring and resourceful masked rider who led the fight for law and order in the West. He moved us to a safer environment in uncharted wild new territories without seeking credit or notoriety. Who is that masked man? Hi-ho, silver away. By the way, Don, if you don't remember, I just want to remind you that even the Lone Ranger had an Indian as a support. When you look around, there are quality improvement collaboratives around the globe, U.S., Australia, Africa, Sweden, U.K., only Spider-Man could spin a web the size of the movement Don has spun. Look around you today, the Berwick web is everywhere. Wherever there is healthcare improvement, you will find Spider Don. As many of you know, Don was knighted by the Queen a few years ago. Yes, he may be a knight, but he is no dark knight. He battles the villains of secrecy and silence, preferring instead the heroes who emerge in cultures of transparency, daylight, and openness. Only a man with extraordinary powers would take on the tasks Don has taken on, beyond those of mortal men, of saving 100,000 lives, eliminating 5 million harms. He is faster than a diverted ambulance, more powerful than acquired infection, able to achieve unprecedented performance in a single campaign. Look up at IHI. It's a pediatrician, it's a knight, it's a super Don. Yes, It's Berwick, who, disguised as a mild-mannered CEO of a small non-profit organization in Cambridge, fights a never-ending battle for truth, safety, transparency, and patients everywhere. Every year, thousands of people attend this IHI forum. We consistently hear from participants that they find this experience to be soul-searching, uplifting, joyous. They go back to work with renewed energy. They consistently tell us that Don's keynote address and the wisdom that he imparts are worth the time and money invested in attending the forum. In India, we call such a person Guru. Fellow devotees, I present to you His Holiness, Sant Guru Don Berwick Ji.
Usually I thank the people that introduce me. I am very much in Vin's debt for everything but this. And I also want to acknowledge Vin's leadership as co-chair of this forum, along with my close friends and colleagues, Howard Hyatt, Joanne Lynn, and Brent James. They've shaped the program that you're all participating in, and I'm very deeply in their debt. And thank you so much for the chance to join you this morning and for the trust you're showing in IHI, for your willingness to come here at a very tough time and swell our numbers. So don't be scared, but you're being watched, carefully watched. The forum, the future, is watching. Actually, the future's here. It's in the room. It's the students, the health profession students. About 200 of them are here. I wonder if the students would stand up so we can see you. With your permission, I'm going to talk to the students. Welcome. Sit down. Make yourselves comfortable. Come sit around the campfire, as it were. We're going to sing songs about the past. We'll embrace the present, and then we'll imagine the future. This is the 20th National Forum. 20 years ago was 1988, ancient history. It was the year when the Dow Jones Industrial Average crashed. It fell 6.5%. Britney Spears was 7 years old, whoever she is. This is my family in 1988. These are my kids then. Ben was 12, Dan 10, Jessica was 7, and Becca was 2. I think this photo is in Cascade Pass. We hiked all the time. I carried Becca on my back that year, and the rest of the kids walked. It was a tough time for kid number 3, Jessica. Her life was just getting revved up when Becca came along, and she said, "What's this? Wasn't I enough?" She thought things were just hunky-dory with 3 kids. A newcomer wasn't all that interesting. Neither was IHI in 1988. In 1988, in fact, IHI didn't even exist. But ancestors like Bland Godfrey and Paul Vitalden and Jim Bakken, Dave Gustafson, your ancestors were already working together on projects that would turn into IHI in 1991, thanks to a grant from the John A. Hartford Foundation. One of those projects was a national forum, as Vin said. The first forum had just under 300 people. They heard reports from 21 teams in the National Demonstration Project on Quality Improvement in Healthcare, reports from total strangers like Maureen Bisignano, who was CEO of Mass Respiratory Hospital, and Jim Reinertsen, who was CEO of Park Nicolet. They're now ancestors, too. They're very old. When we started IHI, we did not imagine what would happen. We were way below the radar. Only weird people enrolled. Most people thought that healthcare was hunky-dory. The IOM reports, To Err Is Human, Crossing the Quality Chasm, these were 12 years away. We would have been crazy to predict what happened in those 20 years. In those 2 decades, hundreds of people, a lot of them sitting next to you in this room today, created ideas and improvements that literally have circled the planet. I'll give you some examples. The model for improvement came from Tom Nolan and Lloyd Provost and their colleagues in Associates for in Process Improvement, our key intellectual partners. I've seen the API model for improvement posted in the halls of Mayo Clinic, in the headquarters of the British National Health Service, and in a one-room clinic in Kasungu, Malawi. Bundles, like the ventilator bundles and central line bundle, came from Roger Resar and Carol Harridan, John Whittington, Fran Griffin, Andrew Capsidel, and others in IHI's wonderful research and development team. Nowadays, you'll hear the term bundle all over the world to refer to process reliability. Sir Brian Jarman, who was IHI's first senior fellow, brought us Hospital Standardized Mortality Rate Measurement, HSMR, which some entire nations are now using to measure hospital performance. The Breakthrough Series, collaborative improvement projects, arrived in 1995. Paul Batalden thought it up. This is his original sketch. It comes from our archives. It's all dusty. It was converted to successive sketches and eventually in Penny Carver's hands into a real serious and long-standing program. People adopted and expanded the Breakthrough Series model in the UK, in Scandinavia, Australia, dozens of other nations. In the US, Ed Wagner adapted the model, so did SSM, the Veterans Health Administration, HRSA's Bureau of Primary Care, Michigan's Keystone Project, and many, many more. IHI's Pursuing Perfection Project, with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation support, aimed for system-level change in pioneering places like Cincinnati Children's Hospital, McLeod Medical Center, Hackensack, and Health Partners. It also birthed our work on system-level metrics, which we call big dots. Our impact network took these over and have been running with that idea. Paul Batalden and Frank Davidoff, David Stevens, and others authored new criteria for publication, the SQUIRE guidelines, Standards for Quality Improvement Reporting and Evaluation. Those guidelines are in your materials for this meeting. And then there are the campaigns, the 100,000 Lives campaign, the 5 Million Lives campaign, which climaxes at this meeting. Generous donors, the largest ones have been America's Blue Cross Blue Shield plans and Cardinal Health. Donors supported IHI's campaign teams. These amazing colleagues of mine who have been helping over 4,000 American hospitals improve patient safety. The IHI campaigns have changed the landscape of healthcare improvement forever and globally. There are sister campaigns in a dozen countries, but the most moving harvest of the campaign isn't the numbers. It's the local details, the stories that have emerged. Here's a story from Claxton Hepburn Hospital in Ogdensburg, New York. Jennifer Shaver, who manages respiratory services there, told us that they're about to reach a milestone, 4 years running without a single case of ventilator-associated pneumonia. 4 years. But they're not alone. Breakthroughs like this are now countless. You hear about them here at the forum in all the workshops. Ed Coffey from Henry Ford Health System gave me this remarkable report of 5 successive quarters without a single suicide among an extremely high-risk group of chronically ill adults. I don't know if that's ever been done before. We see hospitals at the forefront of change, the change we need, like Belen Health in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Look at what Belen's been able to do. They have steadily declining hospital standardized mortality rates, extraordinary patient satisfaction levels in a reasonably satisfied area of the country, and Medicare costs 25% lower than others in their own region, which is one of the lowest regions in the country. Look at perinatal injuries plummet at Elliott Hospital. Costs fall at Care Oregon. Malpractice costs dive at the Medical College of Georgia. Sepsis mortality rates approach zero at Baptist Memorial. Heart attack death rates fall by two-thirds at Doylestown. Diabetes care approach perfection at Care South Carolina. Standardized mortality rates down 50% at Owensboro. I could spend this whole hour telling you about place after place, process after process, that are fundamentally better at what they do than when we all started back in 1988. I want to be able to tell you today the rolled-up national impact of the 5 Million Lives campaign, but I can't. Measuring harm at large scale has turned out to be a lot harder than I had hoped. The AHRQ and the National Quality Forum are both committed now to developing global safety measures. And at this forum, an independent team of health services researchers, a highly regarded group, is reporting out on their evaluation of IHI's approach to global measurement of hospital-based injuries, the IHI Global Trigger Tool. Measuring the rate of the nation's medical harm will be possible very, very soon, but it isn't quite yet so. But in voices like Jennifer Shaver's and Ed Coffey's, you can hear the success and you can hear the joy. I sent Jennifer a note to congratulate her hospital, and she wrote, "I'm printing your message. It will be framed by our ICU staff and posted in our wall of fame. We are totally engaged, overwhelmingly committed, and exceptionally grateful." That's a voice we hear all over the nation from hundreds and hundreds of hospitals. Engaged, committed, grateful, they say. Look at what we're trying to do. Incredibly, these lovely people thank us. Well, we thank them. Students, you would have been lucky to be part of that. I wish you could have been there. It's been fun. And that brings me to the present. Less fun. Students, it's a rough time. Look around you at the faces of your elders here. They're not so happy. They're stressed. Worry lines. You see them? Why are they worried? Well, they're feeling a little helpless, a little beaten down. Partly it's the economy, of course. A lot of these people have been saving up for retirement, and now they have a problem. So do their hospitals and their clinics and their patients. They're watching the dominoes fall, and they're scared that those dominoes are going to hit healthcare, the healthcare domino, hard. Costs rising at 3 times inflation, colliding with layoffs and unbelievable government deficits and declining real income. You have the safety, students, of the long run to protect you. Your elders don't. But there's more than that. They're confused. The old social contract for professions, trust us, we'll clean our own house, that social contract has frayed. Scrutiny is replacing trust me. A measurement follows measurement. Contingency follows contingency. Requirement follows requirement. A cacophony of measurements and goals and demands is deafening us in this age of information, this age of battering information. David White, the master American poet who spoke at the IHI Forum 2 years ago, has a beautiful poem called Loaves and Fishes. I keep it above my desk. This is the poem. This is not the age of information. This is not the age of information. Forget the news and the radio and the blurred screen. This is the time of loaves and fishes. People are hungry. And one good word is bread for 1,000. This is not the age of information. This is the time of loaves and fishes. Well, just ask an elder sitting next to you if this is the time of loaves and fishes, and they're going to say no. This is the age of numbers. It's the age of accountability. This is the age of toe the line, targets, standards, measurement. This is the age of feet to fire. The fire's everywhere. Pay for performance, balanced scorecards, public reporting, hospital compare, physician compare, everybody compare. I chaired an IOM committee a few years ago that estimated that an American hospital has to report on something like 1,500 different quality measures to somebody someplace every year. 1,500 facts like infection rates and fire extinguisher locations and beta blocker compliance and HCAP scores and surgical mishaps and on and on and on. It's hard to find even one loaf or fish in there. It's all information. It's chaos. A nurse called it the gerbil cage. Running nowhere, using energy, draining energy. Now, students, you listen up. I'm going to tell you something very important. You are not victims. You can make this a time of loaves and fishes. You can bake the bread, and you can catch the fish yourself. And the old worried people, I mean your elders, around you, they can do that too. In fact, they have done that. Even though they don't always remember it. Take the IHI campaigns. They built a network unlike anything that ever existed before. Thousands of hospitals, tens of thousands of people helping each other, learning and celebrating. That doesn't take energy. That gives energy. If we use it right, it will give us energy. Let's make a plan to use the energy and not to waste it. So here's a plan. Makes sense. When you're lost, and everything is swirling, and you lose your bearings, get your bearings. Have you ever been swimming on a rough day at the beach and a big wave knocks you over and for a few seconds you're turning in the surf and you can't even remember which way is up, where the sky is? And then you feel for the bottom and you touch the bottom and then you find your footing and you stand and you remember where the sky is. And that is what I mean. IHI is trying to make sense. We're trying to make sense in five areas, at least. We call it our portfolio. Here are those areas. Hospitals. Help make hospitals what the IOM calls for healthcare to be. Safe, effective, patient-centered, timely, efficient, and equitable. Help in the continuum of care. Help willing systems to organize care over time and over place, especially for the chronically ill. Our biggest project is with the Commonwealth Fund, and it's focused on one great signal of integrated care, readmission rates. The triple aim. That's our term for population-based care. Where healthcare, where responsible integrators take stewardship of three goals at the same time for defined populations. Better experience of care for individuals, higher health status for populations, and reduced per capita cost. Care, health, and cost. Our triple aim project now has over 40 participants, and this will become over time the most important work IHI has ever done. Just watch. Developing nations. IHI is global, and that especially includes the developing world, where a third of humanity suffers from burdens of illness and poverty that developed countries have not seen since the Middle Ages. And we are working now with colleagues in South Africa on HIV and AIDS, in Malawi on maternal death rates, and in Ghana on deaths in children under five. And then professional development. IHI is trying to shape a better future for learners in all health professions to help young nurses and doctors and dentists and pharmacists and managers become masters at helping to improve the systems in which they will work. So we started the IHI Open School for Health Professions, thanks in large measure to a generous support from Kaiser Permanente. It will create a global community of thousands of students and faculty. It's already got more than 60 chapters and 9,000 students. And more are joining it every day. Now, all five of these portfolio areas are important, but I'm going to focus on hospitals for a few minutes. I want to explore how we can make sense there to find the place to stand again in these swirling waters. So here's the way we in IHI are going to try to help you find your footing. It's a map, the IHI improvement map. Let me explain. Brent James, who is one of the clearest healthcare thinkers of our generation, has long argued that a hospital has a small set of mainstream workflows that account for a remarkably high percentage of what it does. One of these is labor and delivery. Another would be acute cardiac care. The 5 Million Lives campaign aimed at core workflows that affect safety, infection control, medication management, and so on. Think about a sport. How many workflows make up a great basketball? Well, there's shooting and passing and running and rebounding. They're on the list. And also some cross-cutting things like coaching and maybe practicing, conditioning, scouting. I guess that we might map out basketball in about 20 flows. You get them right and your score changes. You might win. Here's a pop quiz. How many flows make up a hospital? It's a lot worse than basketball. After all, according to the IOM, a hospital today doesn't have just one score. It has 1,500 scores. That's quite a game. How many processes does it take to get that game right? Well, of course, I don't know, but I'll take a guess. I think it's about 100. Of course, if I actually map 100 workflows like infection control and perinatal care and acute cardiac care, you will always be able to think of stuff I left out. There are over 155,000 ICD-10 codes, and my map isn't going to be able to cover all of them. But I'll bet I can get a good chunk of what a hospital does on the screen by naming and mapping 100 processes. Brent James once calculated that about 104 processes covered about 95% of all the care that his organization gave. How hard could that be? What if we could map out, say, 100 processes that explain 70 or 80% of what a hospital does, and then take that as our sense-making agenda for the task of improvement. Perfect them. Perfect 100 streams of work. Is that possible? Sure, it's possible. If you're in the 5 Million Lives campaign, you've already got a running start. You're already into at least a half dozen must-have counties on the improvement map, like infection reduction and medication management, and surgical reliability, cardiac care, pressure sore prevention, governance. And a master improvement map would have at least three types of processes among the 100. Clinical processes like cardiac care or safe surgery, infrastructural processes like medication management, leadership processes like boards on board or training. There would be maybe 20, 25 super processes like infection control, and then four or five sub-processes, secondary drivers for each. Voila, it's about 100. Brent's right. Then again, Brent's always right. To the far right of these secondary processes, the putative 100, is the chaos. There are the hundreds and hundreds, the thousands of the micromeasures and reported things, the nonsense. You can make sense of it, but only if you connect back to what really matters. You've got to face away from the chaos and face toward the purpose. A great basketball team does not keep its eye on the scoreboard. They execute the fundamental processes. That's how they score. You can do the same. If the master map of processes were right and you found your route through it, then you wouldn't have to gaze at the scoreboard. The big picture numbers will change on the left, the purpose. And lo and behold, lots of the little ones on the massive laundry list, the 1,500, they should break in the right way, too. It'll be even better if the master improvement map, the 100, aligns with the priorities of other stakeholders, the Joint Commission, the National Quality Forum, LeapFrog, CMS, and others. A smart map, you see, is going to make sense in all sorts of ways. Now, the 5 Million Lives campaign ends formally today, but the work of total hospital improvement, filling out the improvement map, isn't going to end. It's just starting. You've got, as it were, 12 locations to continue your work in, the former campaign planks. In fact, I'm going to add three more to the map right now. First, let's help with the financial crisis that we're reeling under. So on our website, you're going to soon find a CFO package. It's going to wed quality with cost, as we must do. It'll be a set of immediate changes that can help you reduce costs while improving the well-being of the patients you serve. Second, we're going to build on the successful infection control work of the campaign. We want to help hospitals reduce catheter-induced urinary tract infections, UTIs, expensive, painful, risky, preventable, and now they're on Medicare's non-reimbursable list of no-pay events. But the third edition is especially exciting, and I'm going to spend a bit of time on this. If you were at the forum last year, you heard a keynote speech by Atul Gawande, the brilliant writer and surgeon who also heads the World Health Organization's Global Patient Safety Alliance Project on Safer Surgery. Atul told us about a new surgical checklist that WHA was going to pilot with Atul as the principal investigator. Well, the results of the pilot are now in, and the checklist works. Atul will share the details, but I'll tell you that if these findings are reproducible and generalizable, even partly, then that one change may have more leverage on avoidable complications in hospitals than almost any other change I've seen since IHI began. So I have an idea. Let's use abundance. Let's use the IHI's 5 Million Lives campaign network of nodes that connects over 4,000 hospitals in the largest such network for action, I think, probably in healthcare's history. Let's put that network to work. I propose a sprint. IHI's nodes and hundreds of participating hospitals can adapt and adopt 12 changes in the 5 Million Lives campaign over 2 years. Do you think we can make one more change in a breathtakingly shorter time? How about adopting and using WHO's surgical checklist in at least one operating room in every campaign hospital within the next 90 days. If we do that, the impact on surgical safety and outcomes ought to be rapid. You ought to be able to measure it locally, and it ought to be profound. If your surgical teams already use all of the elements of the checklist reliably, if you have another checklist that works for you, that's terrific. But if not, please consider this WHO checklist. Now, Atul Gawande is here with me this morning. I'm inviting him to spend a couple of minutes with you to explore what's possible and how. I take this moment, which I thank Don for, to say that IHI is a social experiment. And the largest social experiment that you are engaged in now is the idea that we can make sense of a system that's not really a system. And so when we have a new idea that becomes proven, we know that it takes, there's been studies now to show this, 17 years for the average American to receive that care that's been proven in literature and studies. And that's just way too long. And so this concept that Don has come up with of a sprint is the idea that we might take one idea and make it happen more quickly. And this idea is one that affects what is a third of our admissions in our hospitals and half of our revenues. 45 million people in the United States alone have an operation each year, one in seven. We know how to do surgery well, and yet we have major complications occurring in ways that affect 250,000 people per year, kill 250,000 people per year, at least half of them avoidable. We know the steps include things like making sure an antibiotic is given on time, making sure for someone with a high blood loss case that they have two IVs in so you can resuscitate them well. And we know that teamwork matters hugely. A team that knows each other's names, that briefs one another before they start about what they're there for, how long the operation will take, what's important for them to know, and then has a debriefing at the end that says what's important for this patient in recovery. Those teams have complication rates four times lower than teams that don't do it. With the WHO, we came to recognize that not just in the United States, but in every city we checked around the world, we don't do these things. We do most of these things some of the time. We don't do all of them all of the time. And we came up with a simple 90-second checklist. You can walk into any operating room tomorrow and use it. It works by using that moment where we already take a time out to say, do you have the right patient? And then ask a few additional questions. Does everybody in the room know each other's name? Can the surgeon tell everybody how long the operation will take? How much blood loss that's going to be expected? And is there anything the team needs to know? Have the anesthesiologist mention any concerns they have? The nursing team mention any concerns they have? Check if an antibiotic has been given. And then towards the end, a couple of steps, including just a moment where everybody says what they think should be part of the plan for the recovery of the patient afterwards. Now, what's going to happen is that we have put this checklist in eight cities. In every hospital we've put it in, we have had remarkable results. I cannot tell you all of those results yet, but I can tell you that the preliminary findings that we announced a few months ago showed that in each hospital we cut major error rates for all those processes in half. And there was a statistically significant reduction in complications in every hospital we put it in. And then we will go further. In the next couple of months, the results are going to appear in a major medical journal. I'm not permitted to say yet which one it'll be, but you will hear about it. And we don't want this to take 17 years to reach the average American or the average person anywhere in the world getting surgery. And so the sprint is a remarkable social experiment. We don't know if it'll work, but what we ask is a very simple thing, that we can make sure these things happen in at least one operating room in every hospital in the country within 90 days and every other hospital in our partner IHI system. And then further, that'll be part of a process to making sure it happens everywhere in the world. I want to thank you for the chance to tell you about this idea. And I want to thank Don for the chance to take a moment to explain to you part of the goals for the next year.
Because of journal publication rules, Atul is not at liberty to share the details, but let me tell you that when the details appear, you will be stunned. And by considering this change, there are thousands of lives at stake. Now the question is, can we use the assets you've built to create change at an unprecedented rate. Atul's team is going to join Joe McCannon for the D&E breakout sessions tomorrow. They're going to spend part of their time on the sprint. Atul will also hold a consultative clinic on the details of implementation and measurement of the checklist today in this room at noon. So grab a lunch and come back in at noon if you want to hear more about those details. So get on the map, the improvement map. In the next couple of years, we're going to invite you to improve your organization as a whole. We'll start with hospitals, but we'll move very quickly into the whole continuum of care. You can hear the news about the improvement map and our plans for development of it at Joe McCannon's special interest breakfast tomorrow morning. We're going to make space. We're going to make a road for every single one of you, no matter where you're starting to play. Get settled. Get organized. Get leveraged. And get together. We're going to build the full improvement map, a master, overarching agenda of processes whose improvement can lead any hospital as a whole system to totally new levels of performance. And I promise you, we will coordinate that agenda with the good work of the major influencers in the system, most especially with the national priorities of the National Quality Forum. We're going to reach out to you. We'll walk with you at any speed you feel comfortable with. We'll meet you where you are. And together, we will get a sense of direction, and we will try to give you traction where just now you might feel you're spinning your wheels. You know, we should do this even if there weren't a crisis. This is just growing up. This is taking charge. These are my kids today. Ben is now 32. After 5 years in the U.S. Senate working for Chris Dodd, Ben is in law school now. Dan is 30. He's the political expert who first gave us the idea for the campaigns. He drafted the melody, and Joe McCannon and his amazing team made it into a symphony. He is also in school now. He's in a joint MBA-MPA program. And Becca is 22. She works for an environmental NGO in Boston. I want to spend the rest of my time, though, talking about one particular child, my third child, Jessica. Please don't tell my other children I'm doing this. She's 27. She chose medicine as a career. She married Andrew Iliff, the son of British parents who live in Zimbabwe, where Andrew grew up. Jessica's a medical student at Yale, and Andrew's a law student there. They're going to live in Africa, Zimbabwe, they hope, when their training is done. He'll work on human rights, and she'll work on global health. The whole crew is growing up. I watch them in awe sometimes. What I admire most about them is that they all seem so much to want to make things better. On Election Day 2008, every one of them was on a campaign trail somewhere. Ben was in Ohio, Dan in Alabama, Jess and Andrew and Becca were in New Hampshire. They're worried, of course, but they will not agree to be victims. They'd rather make the future than predict the future. They're like you, students. They don't just want to read maps. They want to draw maps. And that brings me to the future that's watching us. We here, all of us today, are setting the table. We're preparing the world for my children and for their children. And because of the career that Jessica chose, we're preparing the world for her twice. Once because, like all of us, she will someday be a patient, and once for her life as a doctor. For Jessica, for Dr. Jessica Berwick, as for all the students witnessing here today, we will create, or we will fail to create, the context that will give her a chance to do what she wants to do most with her career, to heal. So come with me, 20 years into the future. I will be 82 years old then. How old will you be? When the harvest of our choices have become the platform for Jessica's life, what will we have to say for ourselves then in 2028, the 40th National Forum? I don't know. I can report on the past, I can describe the present, but I'll have to write Jessica two letters about the future, not one. She can open them 20 years from now. One of these letters will be right, and the other will be wrong, and I don't know which is which. So here's the first letter. Dear Jessica,
I am so sorry. We stood together, thousands together, in Nashville in 2008, the year when the Red Sox and the Patriots lost, and Barack Obama won. The year of the financial crash and the Iraq war still on, the year of uncertainty and fear, when retirement funds bled and foreclosures loomed, healthcare was still untamed, medical injuries, unreliable care, patients voiceless, disparities rampant, costs ripping into wallets and into other social needs. We tried hope. We found success. A hospital with 4 years without a ventilator pneumonia, and we celebrated them. Our rhetoric said that improvement was possible. It said that the new professional could thrive in a world mindful of interdependency, reliability, the sources of safety, and the power of patients. We tried to remember that transparency, which harms and insults in a suspicious world, enlightens and instructs in a world that is curious and learning. We tried to remember that a great leader does not command, she teaches. And as our treasury grew imperiled, that the most valuable resource in caring is not a budget, it is human spirit. We tried hope, we tried confidence, we tried change, but it was all too hard, and we lost hope. When we tried to claim health care as a human right, we were told we could not afford it. When we tried to say that racial gaps in health care were intolerable, we were told that those gaps were not our fault. We tried to move the core of care from the hospital to the community and then to home, where it belongs, but that disrupted too many plans. We tried to say that a developed nation can have good, solid health care for 9% of the GDP, but we were told that even 17% isn't enough. We tried to say that the world's health is our health, and that the life expectancy of 42 years in South Africa is not just a South African tragedy, but an American tragedy. But we were told that charity not only begins at home, but pretty much stays there. We said that we needed to change the way that healthcare in America is made and delivered, and we were told to get real, get pragmatic, and that that was just not the American way. After all, we tried healthcare reform, and it didn't work. So we learned, or we thought we learned, it cannot work. Well, we asked, but what then will Jessica inherit? How will her life be? And the answer was loud. Grow up. Stop dreaming. It's a tough world and a big system. Jessica will be accountable. She will be measured. If she does the right thing, she will be paid more. If she does the wrong thing, she will be paid less. We will give Jessica incentives to do the right thing, and therefore, because of that, she will do the right thing. I knew, of course, that they had not met you, Jessica. We climbed Mount Rainier together when you were 15 years old. At 12,500 feet, 2,000 feet below the summit, the weather began to close in. You remember? And our guide, Dave Hahn, told you the facts. Dave said, we have a choice. We can make the summit safely, but only if we take no more rest, no stopping. If you can do that, we'll try. But if you need to rest, and there's no shame in that, we'll call it a day. We'll head down now, and it's your call, Jessica. And you said, we're going up. I can do it. And you did. They never met you, Jessica. The ones who thought that this was the age of information. The ones who call trust naive. The ones who call joy unrealistic. The ones who call reform doomed and renewal and extravagance. And so with our eyes lowered and our fear, we shaped a world of contingency and incentive and compliance and rules and timid goals and small safe harbors and concessions to mutable facts. We made choices and then we called them circumstances. We made rules and then we called them reality. And we never made the space for different choices and better rules. And so the walls, like the weather, closed in. And it was every man for himself, every organization for itself, every nation for itself. And the winner was mediocrity. The winner was concession. The winner was timidity and haggling and smallness. And in that, Jessica, even you got trapped. every day, Jessica, you are still as you always were, a good person with good words, food for thousands. But the potential of your spirit and ambition and hope end at your doorstep, and you feel too often alone. I apologize, Jessica. We had a chance in 2008, but we chose wrong. Love, Dad. That's one letter. Here's another. Dear Jessica, it wasn't easy. We were together in Nashville in 2008, the year when the Red Sox and the Patriots almost made it. And Barack Obama won. The year of the financial crash and the Iraq war still on, the year of uncertainty and fear, we almost lost hope. That would have been easy to do. The voices of anger and accusation were loud. The cynics were strong. We had learned to feel helpless. Measurements and surveillance multiplied until our days became full of forms and fights and fears. We felt misunderstood, many of us, by the tough talk of those who didn't know us, who thought that the only way to gain control was through restriction and requirement and incentive under glaring lights. I quaked that year. I wondered what world we were shaping for you as a new young doctor. What world, would that world know you? Would it invite you? Or would it simply read you its rules, ignorant of what you could create for it, wasting what you could create for it? I knew that you didn't turn around on Mount Rainier. I knew that given a world of encouragement and trust and coaching and ambition, given a map, you would aim for any summit and you would enjoy the climb. But I also knew that a world of suspicion and restriction and fear could just as easily make you doubt yourself and head for the safety of base camp, the summit left behind. Luckily, we made the right choices back then in 2008. No, it wasn't luck, now that I think about it. It was courage. The weather was closing in, but we didn't turn around. We went faster. To the people who said that healthcare could not be a human right, we said we aren't asking if it's a human right. We're saying that it is. That's not a question. That's a decision. We decided once and for all that ours is too great a nation to allow the color of a person's skin to determine the length of a person's life. We knew that racial equity and health... would require immense shifts in investment, but we did not run from those changes. We made them. It dawned on us that we had been confusing the pursuit of health, which is our real goal, with the pursuit of care. It dawned on us that the best single measure of the success of America's investment in health ought to be the degree which it can make healthcare unnecessary. It dawned on us that the best hospital bed is an empty bed. The best doctor visit is the one canceled because we don't need it anymore. We saw that our choices were wrong if they forced hospitals to celebrate high occupancy as success rather than the production of health and function as success. We were like drunks sobering. We saw the nonsense in calling inpatient days and specialty visits productivity, the insanity in counting an input as if it were an output. We chose to change. It wasn't easy, Jessica. In 2008, every one of us was afraid. Our economy hadn't seen as bad a time in 60 years. We were staring into an abyss, and we could not see the bottom. But that didn't stop us. We decided to trade fear for renewal. And so here is what we gave you. We gave you a platform, Jessica, to do what comes naturally to you, to embrace everyone. To do that, we made healthcare in America, effective healthcare, a right. It became our public policy that no one would be left out, period. We gave you a chance to help the poor. We met in Nashville, Jessica, on December 10th, 2008. That is the exact 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which includes these words: everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services,
and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. We decided, Jessica, to make it so. In 2008, our investment in improving global health soared. We made it possible for you to look at patients as whole beings, and therefore for them to feel whole. We freed you from fragments, Jessica. To do that, we decided that healthcare would be integrated across boundaries, that we would organize, pay for, and deliver what patients need, journeys, not fragments. We gave meaning and memory to your work and to every patient their own name. And the key principle became that the core of the system is primary care, not hospitals, and that every person who wants a guide on their journey has a guide. We reduced waste, Jessica. It was so disrespectful of you and your patients. Our principle became that excessive care is as dangerous as care omitted, and that often less care is better care. We embraced a duty to excise the overuse of ineffective, needless procedures and tests and drugs and visits. You were afraid you would do harm, Jessica, so we gave you the tools to be safe. We made patient safety a primary, inalienable goal that leads right into the boardroom. We decided the education of young health professionals should match social need, not fossilized traditions. Patients don't need lonely heroes, Jessica. They need stewards, as you wish to be, able to use your will and your talent to climb a different mountain, not just to give care, but to improve care. The naysayers were many, but the naysayers were wrong. They did not recognize as choices what were choices. They did not see that declaring previous choices to be immutable facts is the refuge of the status quo. They forgot that the best leaders reframe as possible what has been thought impossible. They forgot that saying it is our policy means exactly we choose this policy, and that what we choose, we can choose to change. When we remembered that our feet touched the ground and our eyes found the sun, and the waters seemed to calm, and we stood up. What we reaffirmed 20 years ago, Jessica, was simple, and it was exactly what you want, a moral compass and a good map and a sense of the right direction, and the direction is this, to heal. That is all. We are here to heal. And so, Jessica, we hand you a world better fit for you to do what you want to do, to help and to heal. People are hungry, you know. And one good word is bread for 1,000. We bake the bread, Jessica. You're welcome. Here's one good word. Joy. Love, Dad. Now, I thought you might enjoy a little video. Watch. In a forum speech, 2 years ago, a few years ago, I mentioned a story from the Jewish Talmud, and it occurred to me last night. There was a wise man, a sage, who people said could answer any question. And so a young man decided to unmask him. He would hide a small bird between his palms, and he would take it to the sage. And he would ask the sage if the bird was alive or dead. If the sage said dead, he would open his hands, and the bird would fly. If the sage said alive, he would crush the bird between his palms and kill it. The day came, and the man stood before the sage, and he said, "I have a bird hidden here, O wise one. Is it alive or is it dead?" "My son," the sage said, "the answer is in your hands." Have a great forum.